Hello, and welcome to this episode of Not a Lady, a Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman podcast. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Sarah.
And this is episode 6 and 7 of season 2, titled Where the Heart Is, parts 1 and parts 2.
And you're so excited that we finally made it to this episode.
I think more than just me is excited.
Yeah.
Everybody loves this episode.
That is true, actually.
Should we talk about lessons?
Yes. Let's talk about lessons on saving souls.
What you got, Kel? Our OG Grateful fan has a bit of a funny lesson here. She says Sully learned that he needs to make sure Dr. Mike pays for things before she runs off to the next thing, which is in reference to they decide to buy the Bible together for Robert E. and Grace, and then she like pieces out before she can pay for it.
I don't think he probably minded that much.
No, he's loaded.
Especially when he kind of stole her idea anyway, and then she was like, I guess we could buy it together. TV fan 20,000 said, I agree with you both. This wasn't my favorite episode of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman to watch. However, I just wanted to say how much I really enjoyed listening to your analysis of the episode, particularly regarding the intersection of faith and medicine / science. As a Christian, I agree that they are not mutually exclusive. And I think the lesson that Dr. Mike takes away from her encounter with Sister Ruth is that they both have an important place in society. TV fan also put in parentheses, I also think Dr. Mike is thinking about perhaps another walk down the aisle with Sully, winky face, which I guess because they were maid of honor and
best man,
they walked down the aisle together.
This is true.
And then TV fan said, I am so excited for the next episode. Thanks for writing in.
Speaking of positivity for you and me on Instagram says, I would have 110% preferred the whole episode to have been about their marriage and a backstory for Grace rather than what the episode was actually about. I love them as a couple. I think we discussed that it would be nice to get a lot more backstory on them. We don't know that much. And now they're getting married.
We know very little about Robert E. And we know almost nothing about Grace.
True.
Other than she worked for Olive. And then didn't leave with Olive when Olive went back.
Yeah.
Oh, because she opened the cafe. That's probably why.
Right.
She has a new business now.
And she met a man.
Someone else wrote in too and was like, oh yeah, we need more backstory on Grace. Our last comment related to saving souls is from Julie Mazoy, who said, I always have lots of comments when I listen in the car, but by the time I am where I can write, I forget everything, lol. But I just wanted to say, I love listening to you and all the research you do regarding, in all caps, everything. Thank you for the encouragement.
Yeah.
And for listening.
It's very sweet.
I would like to know actually where people listen to Not a Lady podcast.
It never occurred to me. And it's funny because I listen to podcasts in the car all the time. Usually they're board review podcasts for school and stuff. But I'd never pictured somebody sitting in their car listening to us. I picture like what mom does, which is like be cleaning the house or like cooking or something and listening to the podcast.
Yeah,
it never occurred to me that
people... I listen to podcasts on runs sometimes.
Yeah.
It has to be a pretty engaging one.
Correct, I agree.
But sometimes, yeah, instead of music, I'll put on a podcast. But also...
It does help the
time. If I'm cooking or sometimes in the morning when I'm getting ready for school or when I'm getting ready for bed... But I don't have a car where I'm living now. But when I had a car in the States, I would definitely listen when I was driving.
But I would like to know that. People should tell us where they have to listen to.
Yeah, tell us where you listen.
Thanks for writing in, guys.
And we're about to get started on this double episode, so there will be lots of lessons. So those of you who think of things, try and voice message yourself a reminder.
Or put it in your notes app.
Things you think of. Yeah, something.
We have listeners that email us every single like word vomit thought they have while we're talking, and we love it. So definitely feel free.
Don't call it word vomit.
Sorry.
That sounds bad. Some people do send us kind of like stream of consciousness reactions, which we appreciate because that's sometimes what this podcast is our stream of consciousness reactions.
My word vomit. Yeah.
All right. Let's jump in.
Are you ready?
Are you ready? Are you ready? Yep.
Season 2, episode 6 and 7, Where the Heart Is, part 1 and 2, both aired on the 20th of November, 1993. This episode was directed by Chuck Bowman. This is his 10th and 11th run as director. And these episodes were written exclusively by Dr. Quinn creator Beth Sullivan. Though Beth Sullivan's name shows up as creator on every episode of Dr. Quinn, this episode is technically only her third solo writing credit. Seeing as that she was a producer for the show, I would assume that she had a lot of input with the other writers. But so far, of episodes we've watched, she has only had solo credit for writing for the pilot, The Epidemic, the first official episode of the series, and then these two episodes. So I thought that was interesting to consider that this episode is the characters as they have been written by their original creators.
Yeah, that is correct.
An important thing before we start talking about this episode, in the logical viewing order, there are a number of episodes that should come before Boston. Boston is a big, you know, mile marker in season two. And one of the big ones being Orphan Train, which we haven't watched yet.
Right.
I'll mention it now so that when we get to that one, we can be mindful. This is one that people feel pretty strongly was 100% supposed to be prior to Boston.
We start this episode after church, and we see that Sully is at the cemetery visiting Abigail. Dr. Mike gives Brian permission to invite Sully to their picnic lunch. So Brian asks why Sully comes to visit Abigail every Sunday, to which Sully explains that he's made a promise. I don't know why this scene was here other than to, like, remind us that Abigail's still a person. I mean, later they'll be like, oh, Sully keeps his promises. But is there anything else that you could think of where it was like, this is necessary, or this is foreshadowing, or this is... I wasn't really certain.
I feel the same way. It seems that they set up this thing about Sully keeping his promises as being a significant plot point.
Right.
However, for these two episodes, yeah, in my mind, I can't come up with a reason or a significance. Especially, too, when the second time it's brought up, it's in relation to Sully looking after the homestead, which he's gonna abandon.
That's true. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Maybe he doesn't keep his promises.
I mean, I'm sure he had someone look after the animals and stuff, but it seems very important, but they don't pick it up again for the rest of the two episodes.
And part of me is like, maybe Sully is having some sort of crisis where he's like finally ready to let something go, because previously that was the conversation they had about their relationship, was like, I'm just not ready. And anyway,
true.
Who knows? That's where the episode starts nonetheless. When they are getting ready to have their picnic, Horace runs over to deliver a telegram. And in the telegram, we discover that Dr. Mike's mother is gravely ill, and her sister Rebecca urges her to come at once. Or what does it say? It says, come immediately.
Hasten to this location.
Yeah. Which is really funny because, right, like if you were to do that now, to get from Colorado Springs to Boston, let's look it up.
How many miles is it? Or how long is the flight?
I was saying like the flight. Like it's just over 2,000 miles. 29 hours if you want to drive. Direct flight is 5 hours. Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
5 hours versus it takes them, what, 5 days?
At least.
Come at once is a little bit different of like, I can be there in 5 hours, give or take, versus come at once. See you in 5 days. Hope nobody dies.
The title sequence plays in which we have new clips inserted into the title sequence. So that's kind of a significant change. No narration.
In case people were wondering. And then we have Dr. Mike riding into town, and Brian is telling everyone that they are going to Boston. And Horace makes a comment that he booked them 4 tickets, which is interesting. I'm like, I don't know how that all worked back then, but it just made me kind of laugh because it made Horace seem like their like personal assistant or something, even though really...
Probably the stagecoach does not always go through Colorado Springs. If there are no deliveries to make or things to pick up, this would be my guess. Or, you know, maybe they don't come on the same day every month. Maybe it's dependent on the weather, the time of year, whatever. So my assumption would be that Horus had to send a telegram to Denver or wherever the stagecoach is coming from to let them know there are four people who want to ride. Make sure you have room for them.
Right.
Because how else would Dr. Mike be able to let them know that she's traveling?
Yeah. Dr. Mike is kind of getting the kids to deliver certain supplies to people in the town while she's away, because you do have to think the fact that she's the only doctor, she's the only medical professional, and for her to leave is not just like her going on vacation and there's somebody else to, you know, pick up the slack. There's nobody. So she kind of is having certain supplies dispersed to people that she trusts. But it's also during this time that we find out that Matthew, one, needs to get a haircut, according to Dr. Mike.
Another mom moment. How many times have we heard our mother say that to our brother when he was growing his hair out?
Yeah. And of course, Matthew wants to grow it out like Sully, which she shouldn't be too opposed to. But then he mentions that he can't go because he doesn't want to leave work. But more importantly, he doesn't want to leave Ingrid. Lame. And then she pulls another mom line, which is, sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do. And I was like, Mom? Mom?
If I could rewrite something, all respect to Beth Sullivan, I think that Matthew's averseness to going to Boston makes sense, and I think it's a good conflict to have. That being said, because we transition from the scene where Dr. Mike finds out that her mother pretty much is on her deathbed to Matthew being like, I don't have time to go, I don't want to go, it makes Matthew seem quite insensitive toward Dr. Mike. I can understand him not wanting to go, and I think it's okay for him to voice that. But I almost would have preferred that maybe he had voiced not wanting to go to one of his siblings or even to Sully, but then have one of them say, Dr. Mike needs us or needs you.
Right.
Because when you make it Dr. Mike saying it, sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do. It comes off really disconnected from the fact that Matthew's lost his mother. And I want him to be more sensitive to Dr. Mike being in a similar position. And so, I think it's okay that he doesn't really want to go. He doesn't want to leave Ingrid. But I just wish that he had, at the beginning, voiced that to someone else. So that then later, when they are in Boston, that's when he can start pushing back on Dr. Mike, because then it's like, you know, I came here, I didn't question anything, I wanted to be there for you, but now it doesn't seem like we're staying because of your mom anymore. Now it seems like we're staying because you want to stay. Like, I think that would have been a nicer arc for his character, because right off the bat, to have him be like, oh, this is a thing I don't want to do, but I have to do because you're making me, it puts them at odds in a way that I just feel it's kind of insensitive on both sides, right?
Yeah. And I do agree that it would help the storyline a little bit more. I do agree. Even if just for that, to just have that be a conflict like later instead of it kind of that whole storyline already starting. I can definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, and part of me is like, your grandma might die, dude. Who cares about your girlfriend that we never see in this show anymore?
No, it's we've all done that where you don't want to do something, but
yeah,
you,
not because of a girl or a boy though.
No, but that's my point, where I just don't want to go, but I do want to be there for that person, so I suck it up and just, you know, I might tell someone else, yeah, I don't really want to go, but I have to.
Wow, tell me how you really feel. This is making me question everything ever.
At the homestead, the Quinns and Coopers are packing. Dr. Mike has some concerns about the wardrobe that the kids have and what is appropriate for Boston. And it quickly becomes very clear that she is way more stressed out about this entire situation. Even though she's trying to play it off, she's getting on the kids about their vocabulary, about their clothing, and in the end she ends up snapping at Brian kind of harshly about his favorite trousers that he wants to bring, and she obviously realizes that she's not acting like herself and rushes out of the room. Sully goes after her. And this, I think, is the first time, it's not the first time we've seen Dr. Mike cry, but audibly sobbing in the way that she is caught me off guard. Because I think we so often when she cries, she's been more of a tearful crier or an angry crier. But this sobbing with her hands in her arms, and Sully is actually really tender with her. This was like made him extra attractive, just how he took care of her in her struggle, and that he didn't make her feel ashamed even though she had acted badly, but he understood and validated, like, hey, you're worried about your mom. She also confesses it's more than just being worried about her mom. She's been away for a year-ish, we're not sure, timeline, but she's living this whole other life now, and she's had no time to prepare herself for what going back to Boston and seeing her family is going to be like, especially since her life has changed so much. And a really exciting moment in this scene is actually we get Sully's backstory. True. And I think it's kind of nice because every time we learn a little bit more about Sully's backstory, I add it to a catalog of things that I'm like, oh, I didn't realize we really know so little about Sully. They have this discussion about the place that you're born always has a pull on you. And we learn that Sully actually was born on a ship somewhere between England and the United States, which blows my mind to think Sully actually is like a British kid.
British, yeah.
Which is like so not what I would have expected, but I kind of love it. And so he's technically an immigrant, you know, obviously all the white folk are immigrants, but like a recent immigrant. He reveals that his father was a farmer, but they moved to New York City and he was working and died when Sully was very young, which also New York. All these things that I never would have associated with Sully. England, New York, but obviously he was young.
Right.
His mom then drowned when he was 10 and then he headed out west. Reminder, everyone, we also learned in the Father's Day episode that Sully's brother, when he was young, was dragged to death by a horse. So actually, in this moment, I'm surprised that Sully didn't become like a Batman villain, because this is like a real villain story beginning.
Right, yeah.
It also, I think, clues us in a lot to his kind of nomad ways and how he really fell in with the Cheyenne and found a home in that relationship as opposed to with the townsfolk. It's a very nice moment where he opens up about things, and it's not to make Dr. Mike feel better or feel worse. It's just to say, hey, we make our own choices. I came out west on my own, just like you did. And it's something we chose for ourselves, and it's a life we established here, and that's not going to go away just because you have to go home and you might be losing a piece of your family. I don't know. I feel like I'm explaining it very poorly, but I like it.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I do too, because then they hug.
Yes, I know. They're so tender in that moment. It's very sweet.
I wasn't expecting you to
like it.
Yeah, I guess not. I'm like too stunned.
You know why? It's because it's not cheesy. I can do the romance when that's it's true. Not like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you on that. Surprisingly, though, when we have the next scene and they're getting on the stagecoach, they're saying goodbye to everyone, but Sully's like not there. And you can tell that Dr. Mike is kind of looking for him. Matthew's saying goodbye to Ingrid. Sorry. It's like too much for me. I'm like, gag. Gag. Oh my gosh. Like, it reminded me of like being in middle school, you know? Boyfriends and girlfriends in middle school had to like hug and like say goodbye after, like when they would go to their class, you know? And you're like, literally, you're going to go to a 45-minute class and you'll be back with the same person. Like, it's not the end of the world. Anyway, I mean, I understand like he's leaving for a significant period of time. He's not dying though. Like, it's not that serious, y'all. Anyway, I'm judgmental. But Sully does show up after the stagecoach is kind of, it's actually, I think, already like kind of moving away. And Yeah, there's just a wave goodbye there between Sully and Mike.
It seems like the whole town almost has come to see them off.
Yeah, oh.
We don't linger on it. And actually, they don't point out any familiar faces other than Sully. But it's very obvious there are a lot of people standing around. But I guess they could just be there for the stagecoach. It doesn't have to be for Dr. Mike.
Yeah, but I bet it was kind of like a big moment of like, oh, Dr. Mike going all the way back to the East Coast. And Lauren is there to give Brian candy. Like, I'm sure it was kind of like a big deal, especially because, like I said, she's the only doctor in the town. So I'm sure she kind of made everybody aware, not just, yeah.
The next scene, they're on the train and Dr. Mike has this parting line that no place, nowhere, nothing looks like Colorado.
Which, agree. I wrote a song about it, actually. I need to finish it. I literally wrote a song about that exact point. So it made me, I like when she said that. He's like, sure doesn't look like Colorado. And she was like, nothing does. And I love that.
And she recorded a song on her SoundCloud. Go check it out.
Oh, gosh.
They liked when you sang in the trivia episode. A lot of people liked that.
I was surprised.
They arrive in Boston.
Also, that scene reminded me of when I came to visit you in China and we went on the bullet train.
Oh, yeah?
And I was like, because we had been in the city, like, basically the whole time. And then we got on the train and we were, like, riding through and there were, like, all these fields.
Yeah.
And I was like, dang, like, obviously I knew that stuff was in China, but we hadn't seen a ton of it because we had been in the city and everything. And I remember just feeling like a little kid to you being like, oh, my gosh, that's crazy. Like, oh, there's, like, goats and stuff.
I wish that the train system was better in America because when I was traveling through the UK, I took trains. And I think you see so much more of the country and it's so, you get to enjoy it in a way that when you're driving, you don't fully get to, like, you can enjoy a nice view when you're driving, but at the end of a long drive, you're tired. But like on a train, you just can like relax and enjoy the scenery. Yeah. I think maybe I'm going to say that I get that partially from our pop-up, our grandfather was obsessed with trains and he had a whole model train set in the basement. And so, and he told me actually the last time that we were together, he and I, before he passed away, he told me that when he was in the army during World War II, he was like, the best part of traveling from one base to the other is like all the other guys would be like hanging out and playing cards. And he was like, I would just sit by the window and I would just look across just the views and the change and the all the different terrain and the mountains and the valleys and the fields. And yeah, I think traveling by train, America should stop making cars and start doing a better rail system and encouraging people to do rails. And I think that was also being in China. I didn't have a car. I lived there for 3 years. You know, I got around by bus and by metro and train, and Europe's like that, and it's amazing. I didn't know that I was gonna petition right now. Petition America, please get more trains. That's on my bucket list, actually, to do a U.S. cross-country tour by train. But it's super expensive to do, but I really, really would love to do it.
Well, and it was such a big thing in this time period, which is why it's interesting to see how much has changed, but
yeah. So they arrive in Boston. They're at the train platform. They're met by Dr. Mike's sister, Marjorie, I'm just going to say right off the back, is kind of the worst. You know who's not the worst? Allie Mills, who plays her, also Orson Bean's wife. I think everyone knows that. I didn't realize how of Dr. Quinn is, like, very much a family show. Like, and by family show, I mean, like, within the cast, you know? Because, like, Jim Knobloch was married to Beth Sullivan and Even the Cashes being on last week, they were like close friends.
And Jane and James.
Yeah. But she's a great actress, but as a character, she's very judgy. She's rude to the only African Americans we probably see in this episode are the train porters. And it was actually in the 1780s that Massachusetts as a state, 1780s. I think that's right. This is not a date that I wrote down, but Massachusetts eliminated slavery as a state, obviously a northern state. However, after the Civil War, there was actually a huge population of free persons who were working, who ended up moving to Boston. So there's like a huge piece of history that is built up in Boston as a town, including, this is just like a little did you know, the oldest standing black church in the country that I could find in the United States is in Beacon Hill, which is where Dr. Quinn, we don't learn this right away, but later they're going to say that that's like the area that she grew up in and lived in and stuff. So anyway, but Marjorie's the worst. Dr. Mike doesn't seem bothered by it. She just wants to go see her mom. So they head to the hospital. While they're going, the kids are seeing Boston for the first time. I could not find confirmation of this. I'm not sure where they filmed Boston. My guess, based on research, is that it was probably in one of the many Universal Studios backlots in California. However, I don't know that for sure. Maybe someone will write in and let us know exactly which lot it was, because I feel like there are people who know that. But as they're going through what is the set for historic Boston, they pass the Boston Public Library. It'll become a more significant plot point in part two, but outside the library, there are two flags. The first is an American flag, and if you look really close, it's actually a 38-star flag, which was the U.S. flag from 1877 to 1890. So later than how I have dated Dr. Quinn in my head, but still around that time. Also, the other flag is the Massachusetts state flag, which wasn't adopted until 1908. But during the Civil War, versions that would later become the final like iteration of the Massachusetts state flag were carried. So I think it could be argued that maybe it's not official yet, but it's one of the ones that was carried by troops during the Civil War. Anyway, super tiny detail, but also really cool to see that, you know, they probably could have just thrown up an American flag and most people wouldn't have looked twice. But most people are not me.
Yeah.
So I did look twice.
This is true. This is absolutely true. No, that's interesting. I didn't even notice that. Per usual, you are more observant than me. But it's like a clash of what we see. I just realized, like, watching that scene, even when they're just, like, riding through Boston, of like, oh, we really haven't seen anything like this.
Anything but dust. Dust and
yeah, yeah. It's just, it's even different. It's different for the characters to experience it. It's different for us to watch it, I felt like. So, yeah, exactly. But we get to the hospital, and we see Elizabeth Quinn, who we have seen previously.
Sort of. This is Georgianne Johnson. She's actually our third Elizabeth Quinn, the first in the pilot, the next Jane Wyman in The Visitor. That was her last acting role. So she retired after playing Elizabeth Quinn in that episode. And now we have Georgianne Johnson, who I'm pretty sure is going to be our Mrs. Quinn for the rest of the series, including the films.
Correct. This is correct. Yeah. This actress will stay. But we do. We see her and she's in the hospital and she seems to be doing well. She says she's doing well. And, you know, she wants to know, why did you drag these children here? And we also are introduced to Dr. Hansen and Dr. Burke, who are the physicians taking care of her.
Dr. Hansen is played by Richard Hurd and Dr. William Burke is played by Edward Albert.
Edward Albert. They decide to leave her to rest. Dr. Mike's, you know, obviously has introduced herself at this point, and she kind of stops outside the room to speak to them, doctor to doctor. And Dr. Hansen, who's also a jerk, you know, she asks, what's the definitive diagnosis? Of which he said cancer of the liver. And he explains that her mother has been experiencing jaundice. Do you remember jaundice?
Okay, that's the funny thing is when he said jaundice, I was like, I know that we have talked about this, but if I'm being honest, Kelly, I don't remember what it means. But I knew the word when I heard it.
Okay, that's progress. We'll take it. Jaundice. is a symptom, really, in which you have yellowing of the skin or the whites of the eyes. Mm. But it is caused by a number of things. One of them can be damage to the liver or excessive bilirubin, which is the breakdown of red blood cells. It can be from some obstruction of the bile duct, which is how we've seen it previously when we were talking about the gallbladder. He explains a number of symptoms: swelling, pain on inverse palpation, systemic toxicity, and inability to take solid foods. He's kind of a jerk because he's like saying everything is like, I don't know, he's saying it all fancy, like just say that she's not eating. Like inability to take solid foods, unnatural accumulation of fluids, that's swelling. So Dr. Mike is searching for more information here, as honestly, I probably would too as somebody in medicine. Like if something was wrong with our mom, I would want to know exact details because at least I know what
it means.
I know things. Yeah. I don't know how to explain that. Yeah. And so, you know, he's like, well, I talked to your brother-in-law. She's like, my brother-in-law is a banker, not a doctor, and I would like to examine my mother. And while Dr. Hansen is not having it, Dr. Burke is much more reasonable and kind and agrees to let her come in the morning and re-examine her mother.
I just want to throw this out there that Dr. Burke, you know that emoji, the heart eye emoji? Every yeah. time he looks at Dr. Mike, that is all I see. Just the heart eye emoji. Like if you would just paste the heart eye emoji over his head for the entire episode, you would still get the same emotion.
Yeah, there's kind of this, he's smitten basically from the beginning.
But I mean, she's beautiful and she's smart and she doesn't stand down to a jerky old man, which obviously we will learn. Dr. Burke's been putting up with Dr. Hansen and his ways for a long time. So it's probably refreshing for him to see someone who's not intimidated by Dr. Hansen.
This is true. You can talk about Marjorie, your favorite character.
They leave the hospital and take a carriage to the Quinn home. We are introduced to some of the staff, the Quinn staff, Harrison and Martha. It's very clear that Marjorie doesn't have any care for how she treats the staff. We realize from Dr. Mike's reaction that these are people, you know, that she grew up with, so it's really wonderful for her to see them and introduce her children. We learned that the other two Quinn sisters, Maureen and Claudette, will be joining them for dinner in the evening. And as they go to settle in, Dr. Mike offers up her previous bedroom to Colleen. I actually went back to the pilot because I wanted to see how the Quinn house has gotten an upgrade.
Oh my gosh.
Since the pilot. It was a lot more white and simple in the pilot. However, they did a good job of, like, the staircase is very similar. It's just not the same staircase, but the way that it's set up with the door and everything, it was interesting to go back and look. But Dr. Mike's room, if I'm allowed to complain about a shot, I hate the shot of Dr. Mike showing Colleen her room because they're, like, outside the room. And I don't know, maybe they just had a limited budget and they didn't want to decorate a whole bedroom, but they literally are like, there's a pillar and a door and another room. And all you see is like Colleen, but she's like not even facing the four poster bed that you can see that's in there. She's like facing the door, which is for the sake of the camera, but it really makes it, I'm like, what is she looking at? The ceiling above the door. Anyway, I don't know why it bothered me so much. I think they're trying to show that the Cooper kids are in a whole nother world, you know, and have never experienced anything like this.
Right.
But I don't think that shot established that in a way that effectively communicated if the kids are loving it, if the kids are feeling like fish out of water, which I think later they try and show a little bit more of like, these people don't really fit in here. But they do that more right. in dialogue than in actually showing. So I don't know. I had a little bit of trouble with that. Anyway, that night there's a family dinner and we can tell that Dr. Mike is nervous. But what I like is that Dr. Mike actually, her wardrobe in this double episode really reflects how she's feeling as a character. And I think in the beginning, when she and the kids come down for that first family dinner, she's dressed nice, but she's dressed down far more simply. The way that she's dressed by the end of even part one is so Boston. But when they come down and, you know, she's telling them they all look great and we're a family and it's going to be fine. And you can tell she's trying to convince herself.
Yeah.
She's trying very hard to be like, okay, I'm not going to be different just to prove to my family that I'm still me. But actually that'll change as the episode goes on, as she, you know, faces more frustrations with her family not wanting to accept that she's different now. I am in no way a costumes expert, especially like historical costuming. Go on YouTube and find Bernadette Banner for that. She's great for those kind of things. I do like how you see a progression in her wardrobe. And I think this scene is a great example of it. A good tone. And Rebecca is wonderful. We love Rebecca.
Yeah, she's sweet. I do like her. She's a nice sister.
Yeah, and she welcomes them and definitely takes that first step to be like, hey, we're family and we're glad you're here.
Yeah, and I do agree with what you're saying about the outfits and stuff. I did notice that as well. And it made me happy because I think there's a part of you that wonders if Dr. Mike is going to be horrendous about this just based on that little clip when they're packing, you know, about correcting the grammar and this and that. You wonder if she's going to get there and just be a nightmare and kind of, I don't want to say revert back to her old ways, but you think like she's going to start
give in to peer pressure.
But she doesn't. She's very quick. She's very quick. And even we'll see in a little bit just to talk about the things that she's learned and the things that have been hard. And anyway, I do like that. And I think that's why we like Dr. Mike. But everybody knows how that is when you kind of go back to anywhere and you feel like you have to defend the way that your life looks now. And I'm glad that that's not the entire premise of this episode or anything like that. But the next day, we are back at the hospital. Dr. Mike and Dr. Burke, they kind of have a private conversation before they even enter the room. And Dr. Burke kind of like apologizes for the fact that Dr. Hansen clearly has the belief that women shouldn't be doctors. And Dr. Hansen's like, but I hold no such belief. And Michaela's like, I can see that. And she's got like a smirk on her face. Like she knows she has him wrapped around her finger basically already.
But I think like Dr. Burke is genuinely a likable person.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. That's the point, I think.
Whether you are like get away from Dr. Mike because he's a threat to our main romance. I like that in this episode, they don't make him this like ultimate competition. Like he's genuinely a nice person.
Yeah. But Dr. Mike goes back in to examine her mother. She starts off with an abdominal exam, which there's like, so like when I get testing in school, like there's like a bunch of different things you have to do in a certain order. And the abdominal exam is really specific because there's a lot of certain tests you can do to rule certain diagnoses out. There's also a lot of different orders and bringing the knees up, and there's just a lot with the abdominal exam in my personal opinion. But she actually starts with percussion of the abdomen, like where she's tapping.
Yeah,
we do that because believe it or not, based on what you hear, if you hear timpani, if you hear dullness, it can mean certain things. And so she's kind of focusing on the fact that the liver is enlarged, which is in that right upper quadrant, which is important. Did you know that that's where the liver was there?
I mean, I wouldn't have said right upper quadrant. I would have just said it's here and pointed.
But she states that she doesn't feel a tumor. And this is one of the interesting things, right? Because how I'm learning Western medicine, and the most important thing, we take a medical history and then we do a physical exam to kind of help us with the history taking. And then we can do labs and imaging and testing. And they don't have that. I mean, there's many times on this show that I'm like frustrated. I'm like, Dr. Quinn just said, oh, it must be this or it must be this, but she didn't do anything. And I'm realizing that the way that they were taught medicine must have been really different because they didn't have all of access to all those things. So for her to, you know, feel the liver and say, I don't feel a growth, I don't feel a tumor. The liver's big. Like she could have a tumor on the backside of the liver and you wouldn't be able to feel that. But she actually does Murphy's sign, which is where she asks her mom to breathe in, and then she asks her if it hurts more when she breathes in or when she breathes out when Michaela's pushing on that right upper quadrant, which is Murphy's sign is actually a test for acute cholecystitis, which has to do with the gallbladder. In this case, we're talking about the liver. Either way, Dr. Mike starts talking about the fact that her mother likes oysters, and you're probably wondering, where is this going, Dr. Mike? Like, have you really just lost it? But we come to the conclusion that she differs with the liver cancer diagnosis. In fact, she suggests hepatitis. Without going into too much detail, hepatitis is a hard topic because there's a lot of different types. There's hepatitis A through E. So there's A, B, C, D, and E. Just to give you like a general idea of what hepatitis is it's inflammation of the liver. Hepat is liver, itis is inflammation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a virus. It's caused by viral causes, basically. And we're very lucky now there is a vaccine for hepatitis A and hepatitis B. We have a lot of testing that we can do to figure out which one. In this case, Dr. Mike doesn't have that. Also, hepatitis A, which is probably what Dr. Mike thinks that her mom has, that vaccine wasn't released until 1996.
Whoa.
Pretty recent, actually.
I mean, we were both alive. Wow.
Correct. At this point, Dr. Hansen is in the room, and Mike has presented her case. One of the things I do like about medicine, and one of the things I like about being a physician assistant, is that there's this kind of collaborative effort, that there's no one person should ever be making a decision. It should always be a collaboration with physicians and nurses and physical therapists and pharmacists. Like, there's always an ongoing conversation. And I think if you're educated, you should be able to have an opinion on that. And so a lot of times, especially in this case, it's kind of Dr. Hansen's been practicing medicine for X amount of years. He knows what's up. And so, of course, it'd be hard to argue with that. But
and also, he's a man.
Correct. Correct. Well, and unfortunately, that's can often be the case even today. People can feel like their medical opinion is discounted for the reason of gender as well. But his big argument, Dr. Hansen, yeah, he does say like, oh, hepatitis is a disease of poor and unclean. And let me explain why. The virus that often causes hepatitis is primarily spread when a uninfected person ingests food or water that's contaminated with oftentimes the feces of an infected person. And for that reason, because it has this kind of fecal oral route, the disease is closely associated with people with unsafe water, unsafe food, inadequate sanitation, poor hygiene, things like that.
Poverty.
Correct. And at this point in time, I mean, think about it. They're living in Boston, a really big city. To be able to have clean water, to be able to have running water with a bathroom where you're not going to have contamination of that means you're rich, right? And so The things that I just said are definitely ways that that virus can be spread. Unfortunately, it's led to the stigma of assumption that that's kind of where this comes and people of wealth could not possibly get hepatitis, right? That's where his mindset is coming from. The cool thing is Dr. Mikes explains that she has read a French journal that says that hepatitis can actually be caused by certain seafoods, and she's read up on it, which is also a cool thing about medicine, is that we get to read ongoing evidence-based medicine and research and peer-reviewed articles and stuff. But this is also something that we know now to be true. I was trying to see if I could, like, find, like, if there was actually a study done, like, during that time period, but I wasn't able to find anything. But hepatitis A is associated with eating raw shellfish, especially oysters or clams or things like that, because they filter large amounts of water when they feed. And so if they're living in water that's been contaminated by et cetera, you get like the scenario of how the shellfish can kind of carry the virus. So Dr. Mike explains that she wants to do a liver detoxification. She's learned about this fermented tea from the Cheyenne. And not only is she ridiculed by Dr. Hansen, but her mother is basically appalled and said, you know, you should be ashamed, like, leave me alone, which did surprise me a little bit because we flash back to The Visitor and the whole reason her mom even came was because, what, Mike had influenza. And how did Mike get better?
Cheyenne tea.
Yeah, basically a tea. Yeah, very similar. So while I can understand why her mother is more hesitant,
embarrassed.
It is interesting that there's kind of this correlation, right? Of like, oh, Michaela's on her deathbed, your mother's on her deathbed, and we get there and...
I kind of agree that I think she comes on a little too strong. You have no right to contradict Dr. Hansen. Actually, she does. She's a doctor. And she says, your father would be ashamed. But later she's going to be like, oh, you should have taken the advice of my husband's partner. If they had made it more like, Michaela, you're embarrassing the doctor, you know, let him do his job, you know, and made it more or not less personal, as opposed to how dare you, you know, or even just have her mom not really comment, just listen and let Dr. Hansen be like, this is my hospital, this is my patient, you know, just let him be the over the top and have Elizabeth just observe. And then later when they come and have them petition directly to Elizabeth and then have her kind of voice herself a little more.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Like I said, I think the parallels just kind of hit me where I'm like, that's so weird. Would I tell you today, oh, if you do a liver detox tea, you will be cured of your hepatitis? The weird thing about hepatitis, actually, believe it or not, is it's the treatment is kind of conservative. You basically rest, do activity as tolerated, nutrition, drink, you know, increase your oral fluids and stuff. But there's no like real treatment for it. And usually your liver is completely like healed in the next 6 months. So while there are some ingredients in like liver cleanses that you might look up today, there's certain herbs and things that can really help to decrease liver inflammation. There's not a lot of clinical data to support that routine use of like liver detox teas and stuff can prevent you from getting hepatitis. At this point, it's kind of like, if you're going to tell someone they have cancer and there's nothing they can do about it, you might as well try it. And this is kind of how they come up with that conversation later. Outside the room, though, they discuss the fact that Dr. Mike just got dismissed by her mother and Dr. Hansen. I love it. She explains how much she's learned from the Cheyenne and how they've been studying medicine longer than even us.
Yeah.
And Dr. Burke actually believes her, and they come up with this plan to try and convince them. The only problem is that Dr. Mike has done a lot of research and written a lot about everything she's learned about Cheyenne medicine. But where is it all? It's all in Colorado. So how will she get it? Also, I forgot to mention, this is where Dr. Burke says, you can call me William. And she says, you can call me Mike.
So she sends a telegram. No, they don't send a telegram yet, actually. Before that happens, she meets up with Rebecca and they talk about everything. And she's explaining to Rebecca about the oysters, which, did you know, in the 1800s, actually oysters were extremely popular. So much so that there were oyster parlors and lunchrooms that were set up literally so that someone could go in from work and just have oysters, because oysters were actually very, very cheap and inexpensive. And I found a statistic that said in the 1800s, New Yorkers averaged 600 oysters per year, like one person.
Ew.
So it's so funny because oysters to me now are a very elite, expensive, luxury dining item. But during the 1800s, they were actually one of the most affordable types of seafood. Another thing that probably would leave some crossover between, like, the oyster could infect people of all social economic status. If you're eating them in your own home and having them prepared by a cook or a chef versus someone, yeah, who's like going to one of those parlors on the seaside that might not have a sanitary whatever, like, then you're gonna see this hepatitis thing probably show up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Rebecca's super supportive. Dr. Mike sends a telegram to Sully asking him to get her papers from her clinic. And then, this is so weird to me, she asks him to have Horace send the entire papers in a telegram. They go into the American Telegraph Company, which I did look up. The American Telegraph Company was a joint agreement established in 1856 between American and English telegraph. And they weren't called CEOs then, but these guys in charge. And this company is actually, the American Telegraph Company is going to be the first company that establishes in 1866 a transatlantic cable. So a cable that connects, like they put the cable in the ocean. However, in 1870, there was a joint collaboration between the United States, English, and French telegraph companies. And they established a new company called the Anglo-American Telegraph Company. The American Telegraph Company would become the Anglo-American Telegraph Company right around the time that we're kind of seeing Dr. Quinn being, which I guess leans more to they're not yet in the 70s, but in 60s. But then, you know, the whole thing with the Civil War just throws everything off. However, I did look up, I found two different numbers. In 1866, the American Telegraph Company, one article said that to send one word 1 mile, 1.6 kilometers, cost 0.0003809. What is that? A thousand, a hundred tenths? I'm not good at math.
I'm confused.
The American Telegraph Company in 1866 charged per word per mile. Meanwhile, the American Telegraph Company's biggest competition was from 1866 to 1900 was Western Union. And around 1867, they estimated that the cost of a message dropped from like $1.09 to like 30 cents per message. But I don't know how long like a message would be. All that being said, if they're charging one word per mile, and I'm just realizing that you told us the distance between Colorado Springs
2000
and Boston was like over 2000. I'm just like, who paid for this? Yeah. Anyway,
I was like, one, poor Horace. Two, why can't you just mail it? Like,
well, because it would take like 6 days. They would have to go on the coach and the train.
I know, but
I have a thought on this.
Okay.
That I will bring up later, but I agree. It does not seem like the most logical course of action, but I suppose since she was wanting to get those papers as soon as possible, the telegram, that was literally the fastest way.
Sure does. Yeah, so Mike is having a little tea party with her sisters. We do that all the time, don't we?
Every podcast episode is a tea party for me.
And, you know, Dr. Mike has evolved she's evolved because she's nothing like her sisters. Even the fact that she is introducing herself to the help and just paying attention to the people that the others are not paying as much attention to. Marjorie is being Marjorie, and, you know, there's this whole conversation about how they don't want to call her Mike. It's just classic bickering. Dr. Mike is trying to explain the fact that, like, she's really not used to being waited on anymore, you know? It's just showing that Dr. Mike she's changed. And one of the things she said to Sully is she was worried about going home and what it would be like. And this is kind of showing that even after, we don't know how long she's been in Colorado now, do you think? I don't know.
I'm guessing a year, because at the beginning of this season in the sanctuary was, and Halloween was like, it's almost been a year, because we know that she's been there for Christmas and Halloween happened. So it's probably still like October, I guess. And so we're heading toward her second Christmas. That is what I'm guessing, that none of that is well established in the show.
Enough to not feel like she's a Bostonian, or at least like her family anymore. And we kind of have this, it's not a montage, but we kind of switch to the next scenario. And it's Colleen with some girls her age explaining what Colorado Springs is like, and there's dirt streets. Then we also see the difference, right? Because Colleen starts talking about how she wants to go to college so she can go to medical school, and the other girls talking about, like, oh, you mean finishing school? And of course, like, your other friends want to get married. And we just see there's this difference between the Coopers and their mindset that they have been brought up in. And even like that mindset is greatly impacted by Dr. Mike alone, right? Colleen, you know, may have not even said that before she knew Dr. Mike.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple historical things I'll touch on. The first thing is, in part of the sisters bickering about Dr. Mike introducing herself to, you called the help, they specifically identify that girl as a scullery maid. And I've watched enough Downton Abbey to know. I'm kidding. To know that actually there are many different types of maids. And if she was a scullery maid, she would not be serving tea. Because the scullery maid in the 1800s literally works in the scullery. And a scullery is a place in the house, especially with wealthy families, where the pots and pans would be clean, where laundry would be done. And having a scullery is obviously, that was like high tech. during that day, because it actually is very relevant to what you're talking about with Dr. Hansen's prejudice about hepatitis as a poor person's disease, because it's about cleanliness. And we've talked previously about this idea that, yeah, like cleanliness and sterilization is a new idea. And it is not something that is accepted or even just known. It's still being developed as a, you know, just like a norm. And so because they identified this girl as a scullery maid, there's kitchen maids, there's housemaids, there's chambermaids, there's ladies' maids, and all of them do different responsibilities. That being said,
right,
could they have a smaller household where they have, in addition to being a kitchen maid or hostess or whatever, that she's also a scullery maid, I guess. But what they do kind of get right is the scullery maid was seen as the lowest of the low of the maids. This is kind of historically off, but I think they wanted to have that discussion about, oh, these women look down on scullery maids, so that you could have Dr. Mike advocate for how to treat people. Yeah, anyway. I like the transition between these scenes where they have each of the Cooper kids and Dr. Mike kind of building off of each other's stories of sharing about what it's like to live out west. You do have this college versus finishing school. Finishing school obviously was for ladies to learn proper etiquette and social graces for wealthy families, girls who were expected to marry well and didn't need a higher education because all they need to know is how to run a household. You know, it's weird to think that her sisters had the same dad. And you have to wonder if, because there is this disconnect that none of them kind of went in the path that Dr. Mike did. And I guess it can be like she was the baby and he wanted a boy and she ended up being a girl, but then she grew up to do all the things that maybe he kind of wanted a boy to be. I don't know. You know, in the pilot, Dr. Mike said, you know, her father had given her the freedom to be herself. So the question is, did the older daughters not get that because maybe Elizabeth Quinn was stricter? I'm not sure. But there is a conversation about cobblestones, but the only place that still to this day, like historically, that you can find real cobblestones in Boston is in Beacon Hill. So I think what that's why they make such a big deal about the cobblestones, because it is very specific to that part of Boston. So I think that was for all the Bostonians out there to be like, oh yeah, Beacon Hill. And then the scene transitions from Dr. Mike talking about the West to Colleen sharing about her experience, Brian and Matthew arguing with, I would assume they're cousins as well. I don't think these are just random boys. I would assume that they're Dr. Mike's nephews, but maybe not. We're not told that for sure. They're fighting about, it's meant to make us mad, but the boy is like, the Indians are savages. And if you're talking about a few quote unquote unfortunate massacres.
Yeah, I couldn't. Ugh.
They're ignorant. Remember, we had this whole conversation about how Shivington was viewed as a hero because they wouldn't have even have called it a massacre, right? They would have called it like the Battle of Sand Creek, they being like the army and the papers. But I guess the focus of this episode is not to educate with love. It's just to show that Dr. Quinn and specifically the Cooper kids, they see the world and specifically the West in a completely different way than these people who have never been there. And Dr. Mike is defending the Cheyenne, saying they saved her life. Marjorie gets like all in a hissy fit about this. She's furious. Look at your hair, which this is correct. Something I also like about this episode, and you see this in Dr. Mike's progression of her wardrobe as well as her hair. She's wearing it down a lot, which would not have been appropriate for especially like high society ladies. Women wore their hair very close to the sides of their heads and high on top, which they do. I think they do a good job. You know, they have like the top knot and then, you know, some of those waves or curls, which we will see Dr. Mike kind of move into that. Marjorie comments on her skin. She's getting too much sun, which I think a lot of people know. It wasn't until like the 1920s that Americans started getting into having tan skin was more beautiful. Previously, pale skin was you're wealthy, you don't have to work. You live a life of leisure if you're not tan. The other thing, okay, Kelly, I think you'll find this super interesting. I found this article, well, it was someone writing a blog about a historical article they found about skincare in the 1800s. This was so crazy to read that I had to write it down. So I'm assuming this would be the kind of thing that the Quinn sisters would be reading. One of the suggestions of this author was a way to have good skin is if you get consumption. And if you get consumption, people with consumption have clearer skin. This is literally like, it was part of the article. And it was like, we don't recommend that you get it, but it is proven that because of things that are happening in the body, people with consumption have the best skin. Isn't that wild?
Yeah, mostly because there's like a cutaneous manifestation, basically like a skin condition that can be the result of chronic tuberculosis. So
I guess they were right.
That's weird to me because usually there are like lesions that are like warty plaque lesions that can be associated with tuberculosis. So that's very interesting to me.
I'll link the post on our website if you want to read more of their suggestions. It's very interesting.
Weird.
The next couple scenes is Dr. Mike. She just tells her sisters, I don't expect you to care about the things that I care about. I found this whole scene very relatable, having been an expat. I lived in China, and when I would go home, and we would go to, like, not our immediate family, because obviously we have missionary parents who lived overseas, so they get things, but especially when we would go to, like, big family gatherings with extended family who've never lived abroad and maybe have just traveled for fun. And people still to this day like say very ignorant things about China or about where I'm living in the South Pacific. They have all these assumptions about what your life must be like.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how you try and explain it or share what you've learned or how you've grown or what you've learned about yourself from being immersed in another culture, people still just don't get it. And I just I was like, wow, I never thought of Dr. Mike as an expat, but actually she kind of is. And that is a big part of this story, is her learning and growing and realizing you can't just walk in and expect everyone to like understand or see the world the way that you see it on either end, right? She's learned that in Colorado Springs, and she's also learned it, well, she's gonna try and learn it now that she's returned to Boston.
Yeah, it's true. Well, it's funny because I guess I hadn't really thought of it like that as much as just like, oh, wow, how much can change in a year? How much you can really, if you really want to be a part of a community and you really want to make an effort, how much can change, you know, especially for someone that's grown up wealthy their whole life. But also the fact, I think a lot about the fact that I think a reason she's also different is because she's had to fight with the whole medicine and being a woman. And like, I think her sisters knew that, right? I think she's probably had that mentality for a while, but no, that's very interesting. And I do agree that it can be hard to have those conversations, like you said, even personally with people that just don't understand. And I've had conversations with doctors that I'm working with, you know, who don't understand what I want to do with my life, which is to work overseas with underserved communities. Like, that is a foreign concept to them. They don't understand that. Mm. And sometimes that's why I, like, don't explain, you know, when people ask me, what do you want to do? Sometimes I don't always go into it because there's a lot that people don't understand. And I think Dr. Mike could probably relate to me in that sense.
Yeah.
Dr. Burke finally gets a hold of those papers that Dr. Mike brought, and he goes to read them. It's interesting, this scene. She kind of steps outside for some fresh air. She almost seems like she's really missed Boston. She sees the Opera House. Dr. Hansen gives her a scowl. I mean, life is good. Dr. Burke, however, you know, thinks that her research is excellent. And so they go back to the hospital to visit Elizabeth. And Dr. Burke starts the conversation, which I think is because they've seen how Mrs. Quinn can already be skeptical even of her daughter. And he said, you know, I hope you would trust me, but I've read this research and I advise that you start taking it. And unfortunately, Dr. Hansen is letting non-medical reasons cloud his medical judgment. And I think we should move forward with this. And this is where Dr. Mike brings up the point that, you know, if you don't have hepatitis, this tea is not going to help you. So, but it also can't help you. You know, it won't interfere with
you. Mean it can't hurt
cancer necessarily. Hurt you. Right. It can't help you. It can't hurt you. Yes. And so Elizabeth agrees to try it. And there's a weird moment where Dr. Mike goes in to hug William outside the room and they're like very close. It's like weird. But we can see there's something.
They're bonding.
Starting to happen with that. What'd you say?
They're bonding.
They're bonding.
Well, I think also it's refreshing for Dr. Mike because, like you just said, she always has to fight. And I think it's so nice for her. She didn't have to, like, earn this guy's respect or, like, prove herself to him. Like, he genuinely, from the moment he met her, he respected her as a doctor, you know?
Right.
And I think that means a lot, especially in the context of all the stress that she's dealing with her mom being sick and Dr. Hansen, you know, her disagreeing with his diagnosis and her sisters, most of them being pretty judgy, and the kids, she is unsure of how they're adjusting. So, yeah, I think it's like, oh, I didn't have to kill myself for this. And then Dr. Quinn gets an F. Dr. Quinn, the show, gets an F for time progression and transition. They don't even give us a, like, establishing shot.
Montage.
To be like, look, some time has gone by. Because the next thing we know, it's 2 weeks later and they're celebrating Elizabeth's recovery. And I'm just like, wait, what? What have these people been doing for 2 weeks? What? Anyway. But they're celebrating her recovery. It is revealed to Dr. Hansen that the recovery is because she's been taking the tea on her daughter's recommendation. And then Dr. Hansen fires Dr. Burke and no one reacts like that is super unfair.
Like you just lost a
like
major job.
No one says you're firing him because he helped heal a patient. Like why does no one... I don't know why that bothered me so much that no one reacts to say, like, really, this is how you're responding to your patient being healed based on advice that you rejected that was proved to be effective and right. You know, the sisters work through their shock and they thank Dr. Burke. And in the next scene, they're walking in the street. And finally, Dr. Mike's like, oh, sorry about your job. And I guess they just mull it over because Dr. Burke says, oh, I'm actually relieved to be done. I've had my eye on leaving. And so they make it all okay. They resolve it really quickly. But I still feel like someone should have been like, Dr. Hansen, you are firing someone for healing a patient. You know, like, isn't that your job? Like, anyway, he obviously, yeah. Dr. Hansen's pride is his own thing. But I just feel like everyone's kind of like, oh, okay, that guy just got fired. Everyone's okay with that. But Dr. Burke, we have another moment where we see him being a genuinely good guy because they're talking about how Dr. Mike doesn't get paid for a lot of her work and how he loves to do pro bono work. And Matthew kind of reacts very defensively, being like, hey, we're not Hicks. And Dr. Burke is very quick to apologize if it seemed like he was speaking it in that way. He was just trying to say that it's very different than what they have there and shakes hands with Matthew. And it's very clear that this man is a nice guy and he cares about this family and he invites them for a fancy dinner.
Dinner. A fancy dinner in which they need something to wear too because they've been wearing the same clothes. But before they do that, Brian ends up pulling them all to the candy store.
A confectionery.
Of course, we also get another comment from Matthew about how he doesn't want to be here and he wants to go home. But he also makes the comment, which I thought was funny, that, you know, oh, I thought you said sweets rot your teeth. And Dr. Mike's like, it's okay to splurge and be extravagant, you know, every once in a while. Which I don't think is a new idea for her. Like, we've seen that a little bit of like, oh, we'll buy new fabric for a dress, or we'll get you a piece of licorice or something like that. But ice cream, that's like a big splurge. But I thought that was cute, and it's a way to kind of incorporate Brian, because we haven't seen as much with the kids in this episode. They also go to a store to buy some new clothes, and they arrive to dinner looking very nice.
Okay, yeah, we have to talk about the blue dress.
Blue dress is pretty.
It's stunning.
Yeah.
It's stunning. And, you know, it's in the window, and she sees it, and they obviously get it. And they all look great, and it seems like a nice, fun dinner. And Dr. Burke gives a toast to a new lease on life, which I don't know what that means, but I guess maybe it's celebrating him getting a new lease on life, because now he's gonna start off on his own. But that's it. Like, they literally have this whole, they go shopping for like a 2-minute scene, which seems a little disappointing. I feel like that dress deserved more screen time. And then another transition shot. I think in last episode, I really praised the cinematographer. In this one, it's not totally a cinematographer. It's probably also the editor. But it's so jarring. They go from this fancy dinner scene to a fire where Sully and Cloud Dancing are, you know, sitting out by a fire. And I'm like, there are so many more creative ways that you could have transitioned this. Like, have a candle on the table at the fancy restaurant, and then go in on it and then change it.
That wouldn't have been too corny.
I mean, it might have been, but it would have felt more, it just would have actually felt like a transition instead of a bam, fire in the woods back in Colorado Springs. I don't know, it with transitions fire that don't flow, it pulls me out of the story because I'm like, holy cow, why did we just jump like that? But Sully's having dreams. Flashback to Halloween. Remember, we talked about dreams and the Cheyenne belief that when a person is sleeping and dreaming, their soul is wandering. So there's significance that Sully has been dreaming about being in Boston.
And of course, Cloud Dancing, like you said, has explained that dreams are either of the past or of the future. So if you've never been to Boston, this must be a dream from the future. And the very next scene is Sully hitching a ride on the stagecoach. I must say he's looking very handsome in this scene.
You know how earlier you said Horace had to order their tickets for them? Notice Sully rides on top, and I think that would be because he didn't like buy a ticket. He just stops them, and there's probably no seats in the stage, so that's why he rides on top. Some people might be like, no, he's just Sully and he wants to be out free in the outdoors. Some people might argue that, but I would also argue that he didn't book a ticket. He made a spontaneous decision to go.
Correct.
Now, I mentioned earlier that I had thoughts on the telegram of her papers.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should give Sully a better excuse to go to Boston. Because in part two, which we're about to talk about, there's a big thing about Sully doesn't really want to reveal why he came. So I think we should give him an excuse to come that is not what's going to be, you know, the big reveal of why he came. Even if you had added a line between Cloud Dancing and Sully, he says, oh, where Dr. Mike is, it must be the future. Maybe Cloud Dancing's like, well, maybe you should go. And then Sully would be like, why would I? I've got no reason to. And then, you know, have Cloud Dancing be like, is that what your head or your heart is telling you? Which would tie into the title of the episode, which is Where the Heart Is.
Right.
But also, let's talk about, we have built-in excuses that Sully could make. One, have him take the papers and deliver them himself.
Right, because you think that that'll happen. I did for a second when he's like pulling the papers out at her office. He's like looking at the picture of her and you wonder, right? Like, oh, right. He's just going
to
go.
Or if you don't want him to get there that early, have him take some of the tea, because we don't establish. I guess we're just assuming she brought some of the tea with her, or maybe they can get it in Boston. They don't tell us, but maybe have him say, oh, I'll take Cloud Dancing, maybe I can take some of these leaves that are helping her mom get better, and then use that as an excuse to go. Because otherwise, there's just this scene where Sully's like, oh, I've been dreaming about Boston. And then he just goes. And then I think it makes it more complicated because then he kind of has a reason. But obviously it builds up to that's not the real reason, which is the whole everyone knows. I shouldn't say everyone, like, but Mrs. Quinn keeps asking him later on. Anyway, I feel like you could have given Sully a more authentic excuse, even though it's not the real reason, to go, and you had already set it up in the script, but it doesn't happen that way. So instead, we're kind of like, wait, what made him decide to go? Just that it was the future and the future is now, but he didn't talk about it, you know? So you could have added some cryptic conversation,
right, or
you could have given him an excuse.
It's true. So Mrs. Quinn arrives home. Everyone is very glad to see that she's doing well. Marjorie's ordering people around. Nothing has changed. Dr. Mike is saying that her, you know, mom needs to rest.
Do you think Marjorie's the oldest?
Yeah, because older sisters are bossy and mean, so probably.
I'm not denying it. I am old and mean. I mean, what? I am old and mean is what I just said. No, I am bossy and old. And what?
Well, I'm also bossy and mean, so it's fine. I'm sure our brothers would agree, but we also have a quick scene where Dr. Mike is talking to William, who's here for this encounter as well, about how her father used to always say she was like her mom, and she feels like that used to make her mad, but she can relate to it more now. Which is interesting. You know, we saw in The Visitor where she kind of reconciled a lot of her relationship with her mom, and I think a lot of that has happened during this trip to Boston. But of course, that scene ends, and we see now that Sully has arrived in Boston.
Mind you, so this means like another, I don't know, 6 days have gone by.
We're celebrating
Mrs. Quinn's recovery, and then the very next scene we have in Boston is her coming home. But obviously, if for Sully to arrive on that same day when she's down there for dinner, like, it's been at least, if not longer than a week, time in Dr. Quinn.
Well, and that's the assumption, right? Like, who knows if that was supposed to be a couple days into it? Like, yeah, the timeline is a bit
wonky,
scattered, which is not new. Wonky. Speaking of wonky, is Sully in full getup in Boston, and people are like, hide your wife, hide your kids.
Hide your kids, have a wife, and hide your husbands.
Literally screaming, like, get the children away. Like, people freaking out. Poor guy. Meanwhile, I'm like, dang, he looks good right now. We see that he's right.
I feel like they would stare at him, but I don't think they would be so vocal.
Yeah. So that's, like, a really short scene. And then, of course, the scene switches again, and we're having dinner at the Quinn household, one of our fancy dinners here. Dr. Burke is there, and we get a little bit of his history. He says that his family all moved to Baltimore. Dr. Mike kind of explains that she was relieved to leave at first, but she really loves Colorado, but she's also realized that she really missed Boston, which, again, I think they've had these little scenes trying to show that to us of like, oh, she actually did kind of miss Boston, even though she was really worried about it. And even though she's tried to hang on to these pieces of her and defend her lifestyle and everything, we've kind of seen some changes.
This is one of those in storytelling you should show, don't tell. But here she directly tells us she was not homesick for Boston when she was in Colorado. And I don't think we've seen it as clearly as they wanted us to. And just in case we missed it, they literally just write it in.
Let's also bring it up.
The three things is seeing her mom with new eyes. She says it and we're like, oh, okay, yeah. Kids enjoying themselves there, which I'm like, we've seen Brian enjoy candy and like talk about how big it is. But other than that, we've seen her kids really struggling with the cousins. So either she just has missed that, which is entirely possible, but hasn't been made clear. Or we've missed some scenes seeing Colleen and Matthew actually enjoying themselves. Maybe Colleen with the room. Maybe that's what that's referencing. And then the last one is making new friends, which we're like, okay, she says friends plural, but who? Dr. Burke only? I think all of that makes sense, but you've told us it, and I think you should have been showing it more clearly. I can see that they were trying to. Maybe this is just me being too critical.
Debatable.
Yeah.
I agree. But before they can finish their conversation, there is a knock.
I thought you just fell. I heard
boom. No, boom, I was knocking. I was doing like a dramatic reading. And it's Sully. And everyone is taken aback, of course, because mostly his appearance, which I think is lovely. And even Mrs. Quinn is like, Mr. Sully.
Savages don't knock, mother. He knocked, but then he did just walk in.
Oh, that's true. I forgot that line. Well, he did knock, and then, yeah, he walked in. And then we get our favorite black screen with the white lettering that says, to be continued.
Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun.
This definitely feels like a prologue to part two, where all the drama's gonna go down, and I'm here for it. But, yeah, it definitely, there's a lot of setting up in part one just to do all the things we do in part two. So, should we talk about part two?
Yeah, you can't just leave us hanging with Sully showing up like that. Yeah.
So we're going to leave this episode off at this point, which feels a little weird because usually at the end of a Not a Lady podcast episode, we talk about our favorite scenes. We also rank it against other Dr. Quinn episodes. However, because parts one and two are really just telling one story, we decided that we would do the ranking in the favorite scenes of the whole two episodes. So that's why we're not doing it now. But the good news is that when we made that decision, we knew that we wanted to release our discussions of part one and part two at the same time. So you can head on over there now as we continue to discuss this Boston two-parter.